Steve, good to see you. We've got an exciting episode today. This is an interesting for me. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I saw that on the agenda today we have everyone's not so favorite topic, non-competes.
Non-competes. Yeah, and you see me smiling because this is one of those kind of weird nuances of professional life that you kind of go down a rabbit hole and you just really like dial in on something. Non-competes, non-solicitations, and restrictive covenants. That's the thing for me, as you know. So, even before I entered law school, I knew non-competes were a big deal for veterinarians. And it was one of those topics where I was in law school and I was like really looking forward to learning about non-competes, by our employment law professor. I took an entire employment law class, thinking, hey, we're going to spend a lot of time on non-competes because this is such a big deal for the veterinary industry. Well, it turns out, Steve, we had like 30 minutes in an entire semester that we discussed non-competes. And I was so disappointed. Eventually, what I ended up doing was writing my senior paper on non-competes in veterinary medicine so I could take a deeper dive, into this topic that I knew was so important. But as I thought through it, I was like, well, the traditional lawyer or the lawyer that's just trained in law school and doesn't actually seek this stuff out, they have virtually no training on non-competes and restrictive covenants at all. It's something that lawyers have to pick up in practice. They have to be interested in it, and they have to go down this rabbit hole if they're going to be any sort of knowledgeable about non-competes. And it just so happens that veterinary medicine is really affected by non-competes much more than other professions, much more than other, lay jobs. And I'll also note, Steve, this is highly ironic that lawyers do not enforce non-competes against other lawyers. And so it's actually banned by the American Bar Association in many state laws where non-competes are not enforceable against lawyers. And so lawyers don't know a lot about them for themselves. They have to be introduced to them basically by their clients. But Steve, as you know, we take a phone call at least weekly, multiple times per week, email multiple times per week. Hey, veterinarian ask, hey, can you help me understand what this non-compete means? Or, and this is becoming much more frequent, hey, I'm getting sued because of this non-compete. I'm facing litigation. I've been threatened to litigation. I got a nasty letter. That's what we call those cease and desist letter, from my previous practice as lawyer. What do I do? And it's so common in our practice, we thought, hey, this is an awesome idea for a podcast where we can kind of talk through this.
Yeah, it is quite a deep rabbit hole to dive in, and there are many different components and many nuances in the non-compete process. But the biggest thing that I know you're going to talk about is the most important thing is to get it right from the start. Not to not to wait and see, and maybe it's reasonable or they're not going to enforce it, or I'll worry about it later. Nah. It needs to be taken care of at the time of signing your employment agreement.
Really, where that comes from, Steve, is there's this old myth and misconception in veterinary medicine that non-competes aren't worth the paper that they're written on, and they're not enforceable, and they're just not a thing. And for some reason, that myth is continually propagated, and it's just could not be farther from the truth. Non-competes are very enforceable in the majority of the states. And you said it, Steve, these are highly nuanced. And that's where people get so confused because we have 50 sets of state laws, and then we have jurisdictions within those states that enforce non-competes differently. And then we have these states that are changing their non-compete laws. And then we have courts that are changing the common law when it comes to non-competes. And it's a highly fact-dependent analysis that a judge and a jury has to go through to decide, hey, what's going on with this non-compete? Whose side should we be on? And so we've got law pointing in all different directions. And so just because someone says, hey, I heard one time that non-competes aren't worth the paper they're written on, well, yes, some non-competes do not get enforced, but many others do. In fact, Steve, the paper that I wrote way back when in 2015 in law school, I did a research project and looked at all the non-competes that veterinarians were suing veterinarians. And so this is kind of before the big, the big corporate push. There weren't a lot of corporate practices in there suing. It was mostly veterinarians suing other veterinarians. I found 300 reported cases between 1998 and 2015 in that search. Now, keep in mind, when you're running a search for law cases, it's only the appellate cases. And so for every case that was brought to an appellate court, there's probably 10 that were brought to a district court. For every case that's brought to a district court, there's probably 50 that get settled before they actually get to court. We can't see all of that. And then before the lawsuit is even filed, there's many, many other cases that get threatened and get settled, and there's disputes. And so the point being is, hundreds, if not thousands, tens of thousands of veterinarians have been affected by non-competes throughout their careers. You layer in specialty veterinary medicine. When we're talking about specialists, that's when we really see this amped up. But specialists are obviously very acutely aware and very sensitive to the non-compete. But practices overall, they feel like they've got to protect their practice, and they go for these really broad non-competes that will sometimes exempt out an entire metropolitan area, all of Atlanta, all of Chicago, all of Dallas-Fort Worth. So it really just forces that specialist to, to honestly move to another state, which is that's the whole issue with these non-competes. Steve, when I'm teaching in the classroom, I'll talk to the students about this is a decade-wrecking provision. It can really wreck a decade of that veterinarian's life.
Yeah, it's and to your point on the specialists, I mean, I'll see ones that, wipe out the whole of Philadelphia, bleed into New Jersey, and are stretching down towards Delaware. So it is really a needed thing to review these very thoroughly, make sure that they're narrow in scope and that the time and distance are reasonable.
Yeah, let's go ahead and dive into some of the facts and some of the things that we need to be looking at on non-competes. But first, we kind of have to highlight why is this a problem down the road, for a veterinarian. Let's throw a hypothetical veterinary student out there, Steve. Let's say that we've got a veterinarian, and let's call her Suzanne. And Suzanne signs a non-compete as a fourth-year veterinary student. We're all a bit naive at that point in our careers. We're all excited to get a job. And let's say this non-compete is 20 miles in 2 years, which is really pretty common for a lot of practices, even in suburban areas out there, which is a broad non-compete, right? But it's very common. This is where we see a lot of practices kind of start the negotiation. But let's say Suzanne did not negotiate. She didn't do, really her homework. She's just excited to get a job. And she really doesn't understand the downstream effects that this is going to have on her life. Now let's fast forward for 7 or 8 years, Steve. And so Suzanne's done a great job. She's been in that practice for a number of years. Likes her practice. Everything is going along wonderful. And life happens, right? So Suzanne becomes married. Suzanne has a couple of kids. Suzanne buys a house. Suzanne settles in. She has a community around her. Like things are going really well for Suzanne. But then all of a sudden, something happens at the practice. New practice manager, new owner. Maybe the practice sells to corporate. Maybe something changes at the practice where she decides she's got to leave. Now, here's the tricky part, Steve. That non-compete that Suzanne signed as a fourth-year veterinary student often will start tolling from the time that Suzanne leaves employment. So here we are, 7 or 8 years later. That original document is still the document that's in effect if Suzanne hasn't signed any new contracts, which is very commonly the case in a small animal, mixed animal, privately owned practice, and even a lot of our corporately owned practices as well. So we've got to go pull that document out that's 7 or 8 years later and look, what did Suzanne sign as a fourth year veterinary student? Now, Steve, this is a conversation that you and I have, basically on a weekly basis with the client. What are Suzanne's options when it comes to that non-compete at this point? Where do you advise Suzanne? We lay it out, multiple choice question. What all can we do here?
Yeah, and unfortunately, like, we have options that vary from not great to real bad.
Yeah, I didn't say good options, Steve. I just said options.
Yeah. So and again, Suzanne's She's, you know, in the community. This is where she's established. She's living within this 20 miles. So she can go outside the 20 miles. She can commute, you know, now.
Yeah. And so for even if she's driving 60 miles an hour on that commute, it's going to be a 20-minute commute, right? But in most of these suburban areas, a 20-minute commute, you know, maybe a 45-minute commute or a 20-mile commute, maybe a 45-minute commute. It may be an hour commute. You know, you get into a city, you know, even if the radius is 10 miles, that might be an hour commute. You know, you're working at a mixed animal practice with a 30 or 40-mile non-compete radius. You know, you're guaranteed to have a 40 or 45-minute commute. So basically, Suzanne starts this, if she's going to commute, she has to commute for 2 years, and she's going to spend a good portion of her life on the road. You know, and we just mentioned Suzanne's got young kids, right? And so she's going to be the last one to pick up the kids from daycare. She's going to be struggling to get to work every morning, you know, on time. It's not a good option, right? And especially as we start throwing traffic into the conversation as well.
Don't even get me started on traffic.
Yeah.
It's a huge adjustment. You're going from having a simple 15, 10-minute commute to all of a sudden you're spending triple, quadruple that time in the car every day. And that isn't quite an adjustment for people,
Yeah.
especially having young kids. It could even lead to increased childcare costs, things of that
Yeah.
nature. So now you're compounding that.
Yep.
So let's think about what else Suzanne can
Okay, so
do.
that's one option. She can just get another job outside the radius. All right.
So she can move. She
Option
can
two. All
pack it
right,
all,
so
pack it up, sell her house, uproot her family, leave her church or community and move.
this is literally what our clients are faced with many times. Okay, so we got spouse has to get a new job, sell the house, take the financial hit from selling the house. Find new daycares for the kids, find new schools for the kids, find a new community, find a new church. You know, it's a massive thing to move, even if it's just 20 miles away, right? You're saying goodbye to people that you hang out with. You know, and for some veterinarians that grew up in that little town, well, that's not an option either. You know, so okay, you know, this is why I say a decade wrecking provision. A lot of times it'll take 10 years to kind of recover from this one little paragraph that's in this one little document, you know, that this person signed as a fourth year veterinary student. So option two, she can move.
She can move. Option three, she could seek other employment outside veterinary medicine, which is, I'm sure, something that veterinarians love to do after they've spent so much hard work earning that degree.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, when we bring this option up to clients, it's not laughable, but it's like, hey, is there anything you can do outside of veterinary medicine? I kind of make the joke. I mean, you want to drive Uber, you want to drive, you know, deliver pizza. I mean, that's obviously, a pretty low blow there. You know, but is there something that could be done? Teaching, you know, using your veterinary skills elsewhere. Horrible option. We're just laying out options here, right? We're not saying these are good options. These are just options.
I don't like that option at all. So option three is leave veterinary medicine for 2 years.
Yeah.
We
Or
don't want to do that.
just lay out of the workforce, right? So,
That's
you know, she
that
could.
was what I was getting to for that. That's our next option.
Yeah. So, I mean, if she's got a bunch of money in the bank or a spouse that has a really good job, she could just not work, you know, and not violate that non-compete for 2 years, which would obviously get her in the free, but not a lot of people have that kind of financial means to just not work for 2 years.
Yeah, at that point you're sacrificing plenty of income to sit that out on the sidelines.
Hey, not an option, not a great option.
No. So the you know, we're getting down now we're getting down to the options that are even less fun than any of the first four we've discussed. So you could try to negotiate with your employer after the fact on your way out the door. And see how that goes. How do you think that's going to go, Lance?
Yeah, so that's where a lot of clients come to us and say, "Hey, can you help talk to our employer or talk to my employer about this thing?" And you know, and yes, we can, and we do, and we negotiate and we settle these things, you know, regularly. However, nobody is happy at this point. So once the employer gets the drift that you're planning on leaving, the associate's planning on leaving, then they're really amped up about the potential for competition. And they're really amped up. You know, what's this person's plan if they're going to violate, if they're already talking to me about violating the non-compete? And so when we talk about settling these things, there's usually a lot of cash involved. Where, hey, at some point we just have to start piling up money and saying what's going to be acceptable? $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 to basically nullify this non-compete. And Steve, where this usually comes in is if somebody's trying to buy a practice or start a practice, it's often the bank that requires that there's some sort of letter or some sort of settlement that says that, hey, the previous practice is not going to enforce the non-compete. And so sometimes the bank will actually even loan money, to settle these cases and get them out of the way. So the veterinarian will be, the new practice owner will be now in the free and clear. Not a lot of people have an extra $40,000 or $100,000 laying around to negotiate this thing. But here's the thing. If you're negotiating it after the fact, it's kind of like negotiating a really contentious divorce. Nobody likes each other at this point. They're talking through lawyers. They don't trust each other, and they're very unlikely to say yes to something unless it's a really sweet deal for them. And so, to me, kind of negotiating the non-compete before getting into the employment relationship is super duper important. It's kind of like negotiating a prenup, right? Like when we're all on the same page, we're all together, right? At this point, it's much easier to negotiate then than it's after everybody hates each other. And it is one of the most least favorite things of our jobs is to try to negotiate somebody out of one of these things. But I'm hoping that it's probably one of the more impactful things that we do where people can move on with their lives and their careers, but not a great option, right? It's going to cost some money, bottom line.
There's hurt feelings, there's other emotions, and it's after the fact is never ever going to be as good as beforehand. So the last thing, and I've saved our worst for last, you can breach it. Hey, you know what? I'm not gonna I don't care what's written on the paper I signed. I'm gonna work inside the non-compete, and the employer can sue me if he wants to.
Yeah, this one's not for the faint of heart, Steve. And so before we advise a client or before we talk a client through doing this, we have some really heart-to-heart conversations about, hey, you're going to have to wake up every morning and wait to see if you're served papers. If a constable or a guy with a gun shows up to give you your lawsuit papers, you're basically waiting for that fact. What we kind of call this is flying under the radar, right? So maybe the practice won't catch you. Now, in the age of social media, in the age of the internet, it's pretty difficult to fly under the radar and a practice doesn't see where you've gone and what you're doing. Yes, and we've had many clients that have decided to, hey, I'm just going to go ahead and roll the dice and breach this thing and see what's going to happen. And we've got two of them right now that are basically in the middle of lawsuits, based on that exact conversation. Hey, we're going to roll the dice it did not work out. And so now they're facing a lawsuit and dealing with that. So, just breaching it and hoping that the practice doesn't sue is a very bold move. Some decide to do it, but it's also a very risky move as well. And here's the reason why. You get hauled into court, you get sued and hauled into court. We're talking about anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000 to defend this thing, overall. So it's kind of like, all right, we're gonna have to spend $15,000 or $20,000 just to kind of understand, hey, is the non-compete enforceable? Is it actually reasonable, for the practice to defend it? And the second problem is even if you try to back out and say, okay, I got caught, now I'm going to move out of the radius, now I'm going to stop doing this. Well, there's still economic damages, and so the practice can still come back later and sue for economic damages, which you're still basically in the same place. So it's an option. It's not a great option. And for those more working with specialists, it's virtually impossible for a specialist to just kind of slide out and work and fly under the radar. Everybody knows where they end up and where they're going and what they're doing. They're just much more higher profile, and so that's really not a good option for specialists either.
Yeah, I am not inclined to spend tens of thousands of dollars just to find out.
Yeah. And
But
and a lot of gray hair and a lot of sleepless nights, getting hauled into court. I'm an attorney, Steve, and I don't like going to court, and so it's not a pleasant experience to get hauled into court. And that does bring me up to a, kind of an interesting point in a phenomenon that we see. And so what we see, private practice owners are more likely to sue on a non-compete kind of based on the principle of the matter, right? Like, hey, this person has wronged me. This person is competing against my practice, and I'm going to pursue this non-compete. On the other side, on the corporately owned practices, we see a very economic-based decision. All right, what are the chances of prevailing at court? What's it going to cost to go to court? What kind of damages is this veterinarian doing? And definitely, corporate practices will sue if the money is right. If they are being damaged by the veterinarian in violation of the non-compete, if they're being damaged economically, they will certainly sue. And unfortunately, when they sue, they've got really good lawyers, right? And so they've got the best lawyers that money can buy, to pursue these things. And so either it's if you're going against somebody that is, suing on the principle of the matter, or if it's somebody that is suing on the economics of the matter, it's not a pleasant experience either way. Steve, I want to stop for a second here. We kind of skipped a point, of why do these things even exist anyway? And what's a judge actually even looking at, when they're looking at non-competes? Why has the law enforced these for 150 or 200 years now, at this point? Why do they even exist? Well, what the judge is doing, what the judge and the jury, what the law is actually doing is weighing the interest of the practice versus the interest of the associate, of the employee. All right. So the practice does have a right, and they do have a contract to enforce that protects them from unfair competition. That's the exact words that most states and most courts will use, unfair competition. And so there is a way, and there is a need for those practices to basically stop unfair competition. Steve, I was a practice owner, right? And I owned a group of practices, and I had non-competes in my contract, because it was my responsibility and it was my right to protect my practices from unfair competition from an associate. And so, like, if an associate goes across the street and opens up a shop, if an associate tells a bunch of clients to follow them across town, right, they can do a lot of damage really fast. We're talking millions of dollars in damages, taking revenue and profits from the practice in a very unfair way. Now, having said that, we can draw a set of a scenario and a fact pattern that it's like, hey, we're going across the street, or we're intentionally soliciting clients, and we're acting in a very malicious manner. Okay, the practice has some rights there. But on the other end of the spectrum, if it's a practice, if we're talking, we're going 20 miles away, no clients are going to follow, there's 10 veterinary practices between this practice and that other practice. Well, that's probably unfair, right? That's an unreasonable, a radius, and that's an unreasonable, restriction that's on that professional's ability to practice their trade. But here's the thing, right? Somewhere in the middle is reasonable, right? There's a line somewhere in there that's okay. There's the practice's interest that needs to be protected. There's the veterinarian's interest to earn a living that needs to be protected. Where is that line exactly? And it's gray. That's the unfortunate thing after one of these things happens. And so that in itself is why these things are super negotiable. And that kind of moves us into our next, kind of line of thinking here. Okay, we've already laid out, if you're working with this after the fact, if you're trying to settle this, or well, am I going to move, or I'm going to, change professions, whatever else, after you've already entered into the non-compete, it's too late. Because the options are just not good at all. What would be a much better approach would be to think this through and negotiate and reason through this before signing the contract. And that's exactly where we're going to go next. And so, Steve, when you're working with someone, what are the three things that we can really negotiate when we're negotiating one of these non-competes? And first, I'll have to ask you, what's the likelihood of having this negotiated out of the contract completely?
It's always possible, and I feel like it's incumbent to ask because for a couple of reasons. One, you have a, I would say, a good 50-50 shot of them removing it. You ask for removal of the non-compete. If they say yes, great, it's gone. We don't have to worry about it. If they say no, it now opens us the opens the door for us to say, okay, well, if you can't remove it, how about we, clearly define, let's say, the scope, which is the first area we're going to talk about. Why do we want to clearly define the scope? Why don't we want a non-compete to say you're not allowed to provide veterinary services?
Yeah, so this is one of those nuances where you get a just a standard traditional lawyer, a non-veterinary based lawyer, and they just view veterinary medicine as veterinary medicine as veterinary medicine, right? We as veterinarians know that feline only practice is vastly different than equine practice, and mixed animal practice is different than small animal practice, and daytime practice is different than emergency practice, and ambulatory practice is different than bricks and mortar practice. And so you really want to get down and define that scope of practice to exactly what activities the practice is doing. So, for example, if it's an emergency practice, then we want to prohibit future after hours emergency practices, right? It's debatable on whether an emergency practice should really even have a non-compete anyway, but we'll set that aside for a second. If it is a small animal practice, we want to say daytime small animal veterinary medicine, right? So that leaves a door open for that associate to go and practice equine practice or small ruminant practice or, house call euthanasia practice. It leaves some doors open where they can at least still earn a living. It may not be in the field that they want to work in for the rest of their lives, but at least they can earn a living while they're kind of waiting for this non-compete to pass. So the scope of practice is very important on the details. And Steve, of the 1,000 contracts that we saw last year, I bet you less than 1% of them actually had the scope of practice defined correctly. They all just come very broad, as in,
Fair enough.
you can't practice veterinary medicine, period.
Yeah, and think about our Suzanne. Maybe she's a small animal general practice veterinarian. She's got the 20-mile non-compete. There's an emergency practice she could work at within the 20 miles. They'll let her they need help. They'll let her do daytime shifts, which works with the family. And she can stay in her house and she can not worry about any of our bad after the fact issues that we
Yeah.
discussed.
Just a couple of words. We just insert daytime general practice into her non-compete. And that's a completely different concept for her when it's 7, 8 years down the road, right? Has the ability to, like you said, stay in her house, not do this commute, and probably make a little bit better money. Honestly, it may not be the type of medicine that she wants to practice, but at least she can make it through while she's waiting for this non-compete to go. So scope of practice, that's number one.
Yep.
What's the next one, Steve?
So time. How
Yeah.
many years is this non-compete going to affect me post-employment?
Yeah. And so, kind of normally and traditionally, we will see somewhere between 1 and 2 years, but it's not uncommon for us to see practices go for 3 and 4 years after employment. And this is on employees only. We're not talking about sellers of practices and these other nuances that have to come in with non-competes. And so I would say that 2 years is probably the standard. But certainly if the practice comes with 2 years, then let's go down to 1 year. If the practice comes to 3 years, let's try to get down to 20 months or 18 months or something that's shorter there. The other cool one, Steve, that we'll sometimes try to do is the graduated
Yeah.
non-compete. So if a veterinarian is entering a market that they may not be sure of, hey, I'm not really sure about this practice, and I don't know if I'm going to make it for a year. I don't know. I have a kind of see things through, but we're moving there. Spouse is getting a job. This is really important to me. Okay, let's put a graduated non-compete in. So an example of that, how that would look in real life is okay, if I work there for 6 months, 6 month non-compete. If I work there for 13 month non-compete, up to, let's call it 2 years, right? So if I work there for 4 years, hey, it's a two-year non-compete. And so that allows the veterinarian to kind of test the waters. Now, on the practice side, if you're thinking from this from a practice ownership perspective, how much damage can an associate do with 4 months or 6 months of being in the practice, not near as much as a 10 or 15 year, employee. And so, the damages that could be done, the number of clients that that veterinarian is meeting is really minimal on, when we're talking about a month or two or 6 months or 8 months, something along those lines. So the second thing to really negotiate is the time frame. What's the third, Steve?
The third thing is the one that has the most fluctuation and is the most dependent on your location, and that would be distance, your air mile radius from the practice. What is the area that I am not allowed to practice in post-employment for this time period?
So this is the radius. And so, and Steve said an important point that I want to point out there that often causes some confusion. This is measured in air miles, unless it's specified differently. Occasionally, we'll see some non-competes that are specified by the county or a series of counties. That's actually kind of rare, but it does happen. In Louisiana, fun little caveat here. In Louisiana, a non-compete has to be specified by the parish, and so what parish is kind of analogous to the Louisiana county. So there's some nuances here that are they're important. But the bottom line is we want to get that radius as minimal as we possibly can. And so the question becomes, what is reasonable? Where are the clients coming from? What is the reach of the practice? And this is a really important concept. It doesn't have to be every single client that the practice ever saw. There's going to be clients that are driving from 40 and 50 miles away at some practices. You get in a mixed animal setting, this could be 30, 40, 50 miles, 60 miles, the clients are coming from. That doesn't mean that the practice can enforce a non-compete that's 70 miles wide. What we have to look at is where is the number, where's the majority of clients coming from? There's actually some case law that says about 80% of the clients. And so they actually graph out where all the addresses are of all the clients that are in the computer system and say, okay, where would we draw a line that's about 80%? Also, Steve, it does not have to be a perfectly round radius. And so it can be, 4 miles on this side of the interstate, 2 miles on that side of the interstate. It could have something to do with natural bodies of water, thoroughfares, mountain ranges. There's all sorts of caveats and permutations that we can draw into these things that make them more reasonable. Basically, what's happening on the associate side is, hey, let's look at where I could go and practice. What's a good practice that I could go to? Kind of what's a backdoor exit strategy here that's not going to draw a lot of attention and not going to do a lot of competition. And so what's the minimum radius, the maximum radius that I can still include that practice in there? On the practice side, if you're looking at it from the employer side, it's kind of like, okay, where's my main competition? And I want to make sure that I get those folks in that radius, and so I don't lose this associate to a practice that's close by. And it all has to do with like, hey, what are the traffic patterns in the area? Where are the clients coming from? It may not be just a pure radius situation, but those are the three major things that we can negotiate for and get that non-compete in a way that's reasonable for both parties. And what the words of the court use is this concept called narrowly tailored, kind of back to the days when a tailor created clothes, made clothes. And so you want that non-compete to be narrowly tailored. You want it to be tight fitting to the needs of the practice. You don't want it to be loose and excessive and baggy because that's when non-competes basically get unenforced. They become non-enforceable.
Yeah, and I keep going back to our Suzanne and like think about her 20-mile non-compete for a small animal GP practice. Let's say she lives 10 miles away. Well, if she had gotten that down to 5 miles, she'd be living outside the non-compete. She'd maybe have some more practices open to her in that 6 to 20 mile range that wouldn't require a big commute. And I also think about things like think about Manhattan. A 2 mile non-compete would be very reasonable for Suzanne, but completely unreasonable in Manhattan. The last non-competes that we were seeing there were one block up, one block over.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very geographically dependent, and very dependent on, what the local laws are, what the local case law is, overall. And there's one last thing, Steve, which is highly nuanced here, but what type of termination triggers the non-compete? And so can a if a veterinarian resigns, okay, I understand that would be, for reason of hey, they're going to go and compete, and so the non-compete should be enforceable. If a practice has to fire someone for cause, okay, they should be able to enforce the non-compete. But on the other side, if the practice lays off or terminates the employee without cause, it's really debatable on whether or not that should be an enforceable non-compete. And so there's some nuance into what type of termination triggers the start of the non-compete.
Yeah, that is very nuanced. It's very rare to see. It can absolutely and be asked for though. And I like, as we always say with these negotiation points, if you don't ask, it's a no already. So you might as well ask. Now, what are we currently seeing with non-competes? What's the current landscape look like, Lance?
So this is something that's rapidly changing and has changed dramatically just in the last few years. And so, non-compete's got a lot of press time last summer, which would have been the summer of 2024. The FTC steps up and bans non-competes on a national level. It was not a shocker. The previous administration asked the FTC to look at non-competes. They issued some thought processes. They asked for notice and comment, but they issued it was about a 300-page ruling that said that non-competes are no longer effective in the United States, and it was a bit delayed to go into effect, but it was going to go into effect in September of 2024. So basically, we had the summer of 2024 to more or less prepare for this new ban. Now, it was kind of known and kind of debatable on whether or not the non that this ban was going to be allowed to go into effect. And that's ultimately what happened. There were a number of lawsuits that were filed on the day of and the day after that the ban was put into force, basically was put forth before the enforcement actually occurred. And so these lawsuits went through, and ultimately a judge blocked the ban. Now this is confusing, Steve, right? So we've got some negatives here. And so there was a ban that was going to ban all non-competes, but the judge blocked that ban. So now there is no ban on non-competes. We're back into the exact place where we were, before the FTC issued their rules. And for those that are interested, it had to do with the constitutionality of the ban and whether the FTC was exceeding their rulemaking authority. That's the kind of fun stuff that lawyers talk about. But just know that the FTC ban has nothing to do with anything at this point because it was blocked by a judge. What ended up happening during that time is lawyers who wrote non-competes for employers kind of were getting prepared for this ban on non-competes. It's like, okay, if our practices are not going to have access to a non-compete, what are some other ways that we can protect the practice? And one of the ways that really came into kind of a prime time at that point was the non-solicitation. So keep in mind that on one hand, we have non-competes, which are characterized by a radius, and then we have non-solicitations, which say that a former veterinarian can't solicit or render veterinary services to, in the case of a non-service, to former clients. And so those were not affected by the ban. The FTC was very clear about that, hey, we're going to leave non-solicitation agreements intact. All right, so what lawyers did is like, okay, we better make sure that we have a non-solicitation agreement in every one of our contracts, and let's amp that non-solicitation up. Let's sharpen up our pencil and get it more strict and more, and more detailed. And that's basically what Steve and I have seen over the last year is virtually every single contract that we see at this point has a non-solicitation in it. I would say that 97% of them have a non-compete in them. Not every one of them, but the vast majority of them overall. But they all have a non-solicitation. Almost all states will enforce a non-solicitation. The FTC wasn't planning on blocking non-solicitations, and so now the non-solicitation is really kind of coming to the prime time. If you go back 2, 3, 4, 5 years, maybe a non-solicitation was in that, in that package of restrictive covenants, maybe half the time. It wasn't all the time. But the other thing that really happened over this non-solicitation increase here is lawyers kind of sharpened up what we call the non-service provision. And so the non-solicitation becomes highly nuanced in as into who contacts who first, who's soliciting who, is the veterinarian intentionally trying to pull clients away from the practice. But having said all of that, what lawyers will often do is insert a non-service provision, which says that the veterinarian, the former veterinarian, cannot provide veterinary services for any client of the practice. So this is a totally different conversation where if the non-compete has a radius, right? And that veterinary now goes out of that radius and clients follow that veterinarian, right? Nothing to do with what the veterinarian's doing, right? They didn't send them a Facebook message. They didn't text message them. They didn't call them. They didn't see them in the grocery store, right? The clients found them online or through word of mouth. And they come in the exam room. The veterinarian has to say, I have a non-service provision. I can contractually can't serve you. I can't provide you veterinary service. I can't see my former patient. You're going to have to go somewhere else. That is a painful situation. That is not fair to the client, and that's not fair to the patient.
Yeah, how about if your friends and family saw you were a young career veterinarian and wanted to come support you by maybe driving a little further than they normally would to bring their pets to you? And now you can't see them because you're not allowed to service former clients, your friends and family.
Friends and family. So, the idea being here is we really, from the associate's perspective, want to get these to a non-solicitation. We want to remove the non-service language and get them over into a non-solicitation language where it really truly takes the veterinarian reaching out and saying, "Hey, come see me at practice, the next practice, practice Y now. I'm over here outside the radius. You can come see me." That will be a solicitation where the veterinarian is reaching out. Okay, we can kind of understand that that would be malicious and damaging behavior. But just standing in your exam room and seeing patients, that's not damaging. That's just damaging to the client, damaging to the patient or the former patient. So what I'm trying to say there, Steve, is with this whole FTC ban, actually, it kind of backfired, right? We still have got non-competes, and we have more aggressive non-solicitations, that we're seeing. So that the FTC, was going to try to protect workers, and honestly, what ended up happening was is now workers are in a worse spot, because of the reaction to the ban on non-competes that was ultimately struck down. Now, that was the federal level. Meanwhile, over the last 5 or 6 years, we've had a number of state legislatures that have enacted laws regarding non-competes. And the kind of general consensus across these states is they're actually, again, back to protecting workers and creating a harder to enforce non-compete, or creating some thresholds on that non-compete that, hey, certain levels of people's incomes will be subject to a non-compete. So, for example, a few states have non-compete laws that say that you have to be earning over $103,000 or $110,000 per year for a non-compete to be enforceable. So somebody that's making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, you can't enforce a non-compete against them. Now, most veterinarians are over that threshold, and so it really doesn't impact them at all. But we get a lot of questions that say, "Well, I heard that Minnesota, banned non-competes, or I heard that Colorado, banned non-competes." It's like, well, that's for low wage earning people, not for high earning professionals, in non-competes. I misspoke there, Steve. Minnesota actually banned all non-competes, so that they don't have the threshold like the other ones. But Washington State, for an example, would be one that has the threshold, in it.
Colorado has the threshold, I believe.
Yeah, Colorado has the threshold. All right. So many states are making it harder to enforce non-competes. The state legislature is acting. Sometimes they include veterinarians, sometimes they exclude veterinarians. In this wage thing sometimes works in the veterinarian, associate veterinarian's advantage, sometimes it works to their disadvantage. A few states specifically called out veterinarians. Maryland would be one of those. And so there's some new laws that have just come into effect for Maryland. Florida bucked the trend. And so instead of making non-competes harder to enforce, Florida actually made non-competes easier to enforce in a pro-business move. So you can see where this is going, Steve, right? So some states move to a more pro-business approach, and some states move to a more pro-employee approach. And so we're actually seeing a lot of action in this exact area of the law. You know, right now, New York attempted to pass a new law. In fact, the legislature's passed the new law, but the governor did not sign that law into effect. The reason I'm pointing all this out, Steve, is because veterinarians will sometimes read the popular press. They'll get a news briefing, or they'll watch the evening news, or they'll, you know, pick up the news on Facebook or their phone or whatever else. They're like, oh, non-competes are banned, or the Senate voted to ban non-competes. It's like, oh no, wait, there's a couple of more details in there. You know, like, does this affect me? Is the governor are going to sign it, you know, and all of that. And then there's another nuance, Steve, that we've got to talk about. All of these are a little bit different on when the ban goes into effect. So is it go into effect retrospectively, like all the contracts that were previously entered into, or does it go into effect prospectively, meaning that, hey, this is only going to affect contracts that are entered into after this certain date? You know, so this becomes a highly nuanced analysis as to what's going on in the state, what's going on with the legislature, when was the contract signed? You know, it's very detailed at this point.
You read my mind there, because you'll see something where, like, the state changed the law, the company or the practice didn't realize it, the veterinarian's now signed a contract with a non-compete because it's retrospect, because after the law was passed, it's really invalid and unenforceable. But if they had signed it ahead of time and were not going retrospectively, it's still going to apply.
So, you know, and the other thing is, you know, practices are pretty, a lot of practices aren't aware of this as well. Some lawyers aren't even aware of this, you know, so we see non-competes that are, you know, literally unenforceable. We see non-competes that are, you know, could face civil penalties, you know, if the employer put it forth. We still see non-competes in California contracts, and California's banned non-competes for a long, long time, but employers still try to slip them in, or unknowingly,
Knowing.
you know, copy and paste a contract from another state, you know, or something like that. So, you know, highly nuanced, and again, Steve, super fascinating for me. You know, this is one of those things where it's like, you know, I love the, you know, I love the gray area. I love the nuance. I love the fact patterns of, hey, how is this going to, you know, interplay, you know, with other things that are happening in the community. And unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever else, I also enjoy the negotiation process after the non-compete as well. You know, so applying this to, you know, hey, how can we enforce this thing, or how can we not enforce this thing, you know, depending on what side we're on.
One of the most personal parts of an employment agreement, you know, it really depends on, you know, where you live, what your plans are, what your options are, and all the while remembering that even if my plan is to only be here a year and then move, and I might not care at the time, what if you fall in love with the place you move to? What if you meet someone and decide to stay, and now what you thought was going to happen doesn't happen? You know, or think about the person that, you know, the non-compete distance, it's probably a little too broad, but they're already commuting from another city 30 miles in. Maybe that distance is not really important to them, and they'd rather negotiate a different issue because it doesn't matter to them because they're already commuting 30 miles in. And if they don't have this job, they're going to look for something closer to home anyway.
The bottom line here is to really read and understand that contract that's on your desk that's being proposed to you, and really think through, how is this going to affect your future life? You know, what will happen in the future? What are your plans? You know, what could happen? You know, like Steve said, what happens if I do decide to stay here? How is this going to affect me? And really understand that this can have major impacts on your future self. This and negotiating your way out of it, talking your way out of it after it's been signed, is not a good idea. It's not a good plan. We really want to know about these, negotiate these, talk through these, reason through these now before we sign in the contract, instead of after.
Well, I feel like we covered a lot of ground here today. Hopefully we gave y'all a bunch of good information. And we will see you next time, Dr. Rosa. Anything else?
As you can tell, Steve, I always get excited about non-competes, and it's just one of those weird quirks of a profession. Maybe it's kind of like a certain case comes in every time a hyperthyroid cat comes in, or every time a Cushing's dog comes in. It's like, oh, cool, I like these. I like non-competes, and it's weird. I get it.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
See you, Steve.